You're listening to The Sweeper, the pan-European football podcast that brings you all the news from the 55 UEFA nations and sometimes a little bit beyond.
On this episode of The Sweeper, we chat about Surinamese club Robin Hood FC's chances in the CONCACAF Champions Cup, Welsh team Pontypridd's 141-point deduction, and Greenland's traditional New Year's Eve football match. Hello and welcome to the final Sweeper podcast of 2023. We're recording this before Christmas to ensure it's ready for you on time, but you'll be listening to it afterwards. So if you do celebrate, we hope you've had a great time. Looking ahead to the new year, Paul, any football related New Year's resolutions?
Yes, quite a strange one, given the nature of our work, but I'd like to go to more football matches. I've realised I don't actually go to that many games these days. I think we've got ahead in so many different places with researching and looking at scores online and reading about stuff, but don't actually get out and see as much as I'd like. So aside from obviously the dream trips that I hope to make this year, which could be San Marino, maybe we'll finally get back to Greenland. But yeah, just generally getting to games, which I feel probably not one that you need, because you seem to be pretty much at a football match every time I see you online. But for me, definitely,
it has been a good year for getting to games for me personally. Obviously, that France trip, and I think around six or seven countries in total, including San Marino. I presume the San Marino trip that you'd be doing would be for that St. Kitts and Nevis doubleheader potentially in March.
Potentially. And the agony of it is, I don't think I can go for both. I think that would be a long time to be in San Marino for anyone. So I think the logical thing to do is you have to go to the first one, because if they win that game, the second one becomes pretty damp squib, doesn't it? But what's most likely to happen, I think, is they'll draw that first one. Yeah. And if they win the second one, if they get their historic first win in, you know, 20 years, and I've left 3 days before, I'm going to feel like a prize idiot.
That would be typical, wouldn't it? My dad said to me yesterday, he said, San Marino comes up on your podcast a lot, doesn't it? And I just thought to myself, yeah, it really does.
It does. I think they're also, we get the strongest response from San Marino. I think it's this thing of being the bottom of the rankings. You know, everyone can identify with that. But also the wait for a win. And we've discussed this before. If they do get their win, is it just going to kind of put a pin in the whole thing? Because I feel like there is more and more interest in San Marino, but I think it is linked to this like 20-year wait for a win, which is pretty much unique. And if they do get it, are people going to be so excited about going for the second win? I'm not sure.
Yeah, probably not. Well, believe it or not, listeners, there are some other things that we will be keeping our eyes on in 2024, not just San Marino. And one of those is the CONCACAF Champions Cup, which is the North and Central American equivalent of the Champions League. It's going to take place between February and June. This is quite an interesting competition, Paul. Some quirks to it that you don't tend to get with UEFA competitions. It's an all-knockout competition. So 27 teams, five of them going straight through to the last 16, the other 11 determined by a first-round knockout tie between the other 22 clubs. No country protection either. What do you make of that? These are not things that we see in European competitions at the moment.
They're not. And I wondered if the group stage thing, the fact there's no group stage, is due to the significant distances involved. Because even though there are big distances in European ties, there are also some quite close ones. Whereas here, it seemed to me, and you're the one who will have definitely got out Google Maps and had a look, but it seemed to me that if you had a group of four, you would have some pretty astronomical flying to do.
Yeah, that could be a reason. I did see, as I think you did as well, the map that somebody called Ben Wright tweeted a few weeks ago now. It was this beautifully designed map with all of the badges of the clubs in their respective locations in North and Central America, with the caption, "The European mind simply cannot comprehend, like we've never had a good away day before." And I thought to myself, this guy doesn't follow the Sweeper, does he?
Yeah, that's the one thing you can guarantee, isn't it? Yeah, I think our mind can comprehend some pretty big away days. We've dealt with the Coupe de France, so I think beyond that, everything feels pretty pathetic, doesn't it? But the only way that it is different, maybe, is the fact there are no close ones. Because even within the all US ties that could get thrown up, the distances are never like an England to France kind of distance. You're looking at significant distances. In terms of the lack of country protection, I think that's a very good point. And what was really interesting to me was that with that in mind, looking at the draw, they've had a very lucky one in that there are, I think, five Mexican representatives who are all separated. The only two teams that are playing each other from the same country are St. Louis City and Houston Dynamo from the US. But I feel like they've had a bit of a lucky run of it if they did want to sort of spread out the games, because it's fallen that they're almost all teams from different countries, and some brilliant draws in there as well. Really exciting draw to look at.
Yeah, that all US tie you mentioned there, I think they're 1,000 kilometers apart. So that's still a pretty significant distance, isn't it, for two clubs in the same country.
And that's, as I say, within the framework, probably one of the better ties you could have in terms of short distances. Because, yeah, even within the US teams, I suppose if Philadelphia had met New England, you would have had a much shorter one. Nashville to Orlando, I think, is a lot shorter. This is probably where we get an irate message from our US listeners. But yeah, there are some beautiful ties in there. And as someone who by no means would call himself an expert in CONCACAF football, seeing teams I didn't even realise existed just pop up. So the one I'm thinking of particularly is the brilliantly named Comunicaciones FC from Guatemala, which I just loved, a team being called Communications. So yeah, really, really great tie, a mixture of teams that are very familiar and quite big names, and some teams that, yeah, really, I think I would never have heard of before.
One of the other teams in the draw, of course, is Lionel Messi's Inter Miami. I should say Lionel Messi and Luis Suarez's Inter Miami now. And they could be rocking up, Paul, on the shores of Suriname, because one thing that's quite sort of interesting when you look at the geographical spread of the clubs that are taking part in this competition is that they're all either in North Central America or the Caribbean. And then there's Suriname, which is sort of out on its own down there. And I would have really presumed that Suriname would have been part of CONMEBOL, the South American Football Federation. Why do you think that we are seeing Suriname and their representative, the brilliantly named Robin Hood FC, taking part in this competition?
This was a bit of a curveball for me as well. I'd never really fully considered that. I suppose the reason that most people seem to put out for this is that, simply put, they are not good enough to compete in South America. I think there's probably an element of truth in that, but there's also quite a compelling case that they may be joined CONCACAF because actually the travel involved is much easier for them. It's much easier for them to get to other CONCACAF nations than it is within South America. It could also be to do with this thing of CONCACAF being very well set up to have nations that are, you know, territories, and within other nations sort of overseas territories, they're much more set up for that than other federations. So we saw that with Greenland and UEFA. Greenland are definitely not going into UEFA, but they're looking at CONCACAF, for example, because there is a precedent there that you get a lot of places in CONCACAF who are effectively owned by, say, France or you know, another country. So I don't know is the exact reason, but it definitely works better for them on a football level.
Let's talk a little bit more about Robin Hood FC now, because they've got quite an interesting backstory, haven't they? What is that backstory?
So they, as you might expect, I suppose, from the name, they were set up to encourage young, poorer boys and men to play football in their community where opportunities hadn't existed before. So they were set up sort of way back in 1945, I think, just as a kind of recreational team. And yeah, the idea was very much to be like a team for the people and for people who maybe wouldn't be able to play otherwise. So they got this fantastic name. I don't know if they robbed all their money from richer teams, but there's no mention of that. But I love it as a concept. And they have a beautiful badge as well. Really cool badge with two cross swords and quite a unique couple of colours, like a sort of dark green and red stripes, which I can't think off the top of my head of anyone else who plays in dark green and red stripes. There probably is someone.
Wouldn't it be Fluminense, who just played Manchester City in the Club World Cup final? Don't they play in red and green?
Ooh, that's a very strong call. Yeah, I mean, if I was a pedant, I think it's a slightly different red, but that's a very good call. I think it's pretty much that. Yeah, but there you go. I knew I couldn't sneak that past you.
They've had quite a spectacular year, Robin Hood, because they won the 2023 Caribbean Shield. And I don't know if you know who they happen to beat in the final of that competition.
I don't, but I vaguely remember us talking about it, but I don't remember it now.
It's our friends Golden Lion, the club from Martinique that have got to the ninth or is it 10th round now? I always lose count of the Coupe de France where they'll face Lille. So yeah, they beat Golden Lion in the 2023 Caribbean Shield and then also won the 2023 Caribbean Cup against Cavalier of Jamaica. So they've had probably one of the best years in their history, winning two Caribbean trophies. Quite spectacular.
Yeah, really amazing. And Robin Hood versus Cavalier very much sounds like something from a sort of storybook, doesn't it? That's
Yeah.
brilliant. Brilliant tie. They sound like they're doing very well. And actually, it's recognized in terms of, I believe they're one of the teams that go through and start from the round of 16, are they not? So there is a seeding system. You mentioned Luis Suarez and to a lesser extent, Leo Messi's into Miami. They come in the second round as well, this round of 16. And so do Robin Hood and a few others. So yeah, they've obviously done well enough to get that bye, which is quite interesting when you look at, you know, the respective size of their footballing nations, that a club from Suriname is getting that bye through along with Inter Miami.
Well, if these two particular European minds can manage to comprehend, we will provide you with some updates about the CONCACAF Champions Cup in the new year. But for now, we're going to move on to another continental competition, and that is the Asian Champions League, where we're going to cover the story of Vanfore Kofu, the Japanese second division club that have just made it to the knockout stages. This particular story began last year in 2022 when they won the Japanese Cup, the Emperor's Cup, thanks to a winning penalty in the shootout by a 42-year-old striker, Hideyomi Manamoto, I think his name is, and then subsequently qualified for the Asian Champions League. And the reason that the cup winners go into the Champions League is something that I think a lot of European fans won't understand, because obviously here your cup winners go into the Conference League qualifying rounds. In Asia, it works a little bit differently, but going to the Champions League, they did. They come through a group with Melbourne City, the Australian champions, Buriram United, the Thai champions, and Zhejiang Professional of China. This is incredible, isn't it? I mean, I don't really know how to put into words how unique a feat this is for a second division team to get to the knockout stages of a continental competition.
When we were talking about how they were even qualifying for the tournament in the first place, that seemed like a bit of a miracle. And then to come into a group that, you know, it's not a weak group, and to top that group, it's absolutely incredible, really. If you wanted to put a negative spin on it, maybe you would suggest that it shows that Japanese football is way above the level of certain other countries in the region. But I think really you just got to look on the positive and say what an amazing achievement from them, really.
Let's compare it to European football then, because it is quite hard to understand how this can happen. If you had, say, a second division team with a lot of history and generally a predominant team, the likes of Leeds in England or Bordeaux in France or Schalke in Germany, all playing in their second divisions right now. If they were to play against, say, Nordsjælland or Victoria Pilsen, one of the dominant teams in their respective countries, but slightly smaller countries, do you think they would go through?
I don't think they would, personally. It's a really good question. And I think there is obviously this argument that a league such as the Championship in England is so competitive and so strong, and you see the quality of players in that league is so high. But I just don't think so. I think when you look at these sort of I'd suppose you could call them second tier or middle tier European outfits who play year after year in European competition, they just build up so much experience and strength in the fact that they are taking on the very best. I would really struggle to see a scenario where this could happen in Europe. But I don't know. I don't know if you agree with that. That's just my feeling.
Yeah, probably. I think that it would be harder for a European team to do that if they're in the second division. I don't think the likes of Leeds, Bordeaux or Schalke would be able to beat one of those teams that are regularly playing in continental football and have probably got a stronger squad. So I think maybe it's just something that's sort of unique to Asia, where there does seem to be quite a big disparity between certain countries. And I wonder if that's why the Asian Football Confederation have decided to rejig their competitions a little bit from, I think it's from the end of this season, because rather than having the AFC Champions League and the very much secondary AFC Cup, they're going to be introducing an Asian Champions League 2 and an AFC Challenge League. So three competitions, just like Europe. And I wonder if that's the AFC sort of looking over curiously and noticing the success of these three competitions in Europe at the moment.
That would make a lot of sense. I think one thing that jumps out at you when you look at the AFC Champions League groups is that there are a few teams here who got 0 points. And I think that's never a brilliant look. I think, you know, it's not at all to the, I'm not criticizing those teams. They obviously did very well to get there. They're competing as best they can, but they're up against a lot of disadvantages. But you look, there were, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 teams that picked up 0 points from 6 games. And you just wonder in that situation whether this new system might actually be more healthy. I'm also thinking to countries like Mongolia, where FC Ulaanbaatar have actually done very well in the AFC Cup. They haven't managed to get through, but they've won some points. And there's probably a sense for those nations that there's a difficulty in climbing up to that next rung. So perhaps what this will do is sort of what it's done in Europe, is give a better focus to nations who are on the up. But still, you know, when you look at the superpowers, they're going to struggle to compete with South Korea and Japan and you know, not so much China at the moment, but, you know, South Korea and Japan really dominating that eastern region.
We will, of course, be tracking the progress of Onfray Kofu in the new year. Hopefully they can get really deep into the Asian Champions League. And my God, can you imagine if they won it? So we will, of course, be covering that in detail. But for now, we're going to round off part one and come back for part two to talk about some stories from Wales and the Netherlands. Welcome back to part two of the Sweeper podcast, and we're going to kick off with a story from Wales concerning the Welsh Premier League club Pontypridd. Now, Paul, before we came on air to do this story, I actually went onto YouTube and had a listen to how you pronounce the name of Pontypridd, because we came under some criticism before, didn't we, for our Welsh pronunciation?
We got some flack, and my nan was Welsh. We grew up with her teaching us basic phrases and pronunciations. So the last time we mentioned a Welsh team, I thought, yeah, you know, definitely going to nail this. We got more abuse for that than we do for what I'm sure are some terrible pronunciations of teams from places like Montenegro and Bhutan even. But yes, we're going to get it right this time. I think Pontypridd, I can't see anyone arguing with that. Let's hope we've appeased the Welsh listenership with that one.
It is an occupational hazard, isn't it, covering world football and trying to pronounce all of the team and player names.
Yeah, and I do say that to people, you know, we really do make an effort. Like, we will absolutely do our best, but when your area you're covering is the entire world, it gets more difficult. You know, if we were just covering wherever, Germany, Hungary, Italy, we would definitely have those pronunciations right down. But it is more difficult when you're covering scores of leagues. It's not easy to be brilliant at pronouncing any of them. Although that said, we always love to hear constructive criticism. I definitely learned how to say Budućnost Podgorica a lot better because of some constructive criticism.
Yeah,
I'm happy to take it. But yeah, please don't assume that we think we're great at pronouncing. We know we're not.
On to the Pontypridd story. The reason they've come to our attention is because they have been subjected to, I think, one of, if not the biggest, points deduction in all of football history. That's because they faced 18 charges from the Football Association of Wales relating to not paying players, breaching player contracts, failing to register players correctly, and fielding ineligible players. The sort of breakdown of this points deduction is very interesting, isn't it? Because it's 141 points, but only 6 of them now, and the remaining 135 on hold in case they commit any future offences.
Yes. Now, that's an interesting one, isn't it? What a strange system. For a start, what a strange number of points to have come to. I don't know exactly how that was worked out. And a very, very odd division of the points deduction. I mean, all I can imagine is they want to put the absolute fear of God into them when they're putting the team sheet in each week. You'd certainly not be taking any chances, would you? You have every single player come with their registration documents, check them off every single time. Very weird. I mean, I don't understand how they came to that figure.
You know, one of the reasons why I think it's especially weird is because Airbus Broughton had points deducted last season. The team that didn't win a single game all season. And I think that they had points deducted in one instance for fielding an ineligible player. And in one instance, it was a 3-point deduction. And then in another one, actually, I think it was another 3-point deduction. So in total, they're on minus 6. But they've gone from deducting 3 points last season to a casual 141 this season. It just doesn't make sense, does it?
No. And if you look at it as being how much advantage they gained, I mean, who were they fielding? Lionel Messi? Or, you know, how bad were these ineligible players? How ineligible were they? I do feel like someone has just spun a sort of, or maybe thrown darts at a board. Maybe that's what they agreed, because most people aren't that great at darts. They said, look, wherever you hit, that's our penalty. And someone just managed to rack up 141.
How does this compare with other historical points deductions? What sort of stands out when somebody tells you about big points deductions?
I think it, like, indelibly on my brain are the Calciopoli ones in Italy. So I was an Italian football journalist around 2005, 2006. And I remember when those points deductions started to come down. Being Italy, it was chaos, and they were wavering all over the place, and the points deductions were never clear. But they were huge, I believe, some of those ones. But they were all put into perspective by the fact Juventus were actively relegated. They were just sent down to Serie B. So you had this amazing year where Juventus, who kept quite a lot of their best players, were suddenly playing in second division stadiums, which was fantastically fun to watch as a neutral. But I believe there were also crippling penalties put on three other clubs at that time, and I mean, it basically just by default made into the powerhouse. But I think those points penalties were pretty high, weren't they? I can't remember exactly what they were, but they gave pretty significant ones to the other teams involved.
I think they're around the 30 point mark, which is obviously, you know, potentially 10 wins there. That's a heavy one. More recently, of course, we talked around May and June time about the Belarusian points deduction for those three teams. And Shakhtar Soligorsk, who were the stripped 2022 champions, had a total of 55 points deducted over two seasons, which is one of the heaviest that I can ever remember hearing. 35 points this season, which meant that they literally just finished above the relegation playoff place, and 20 points heading into next season as well.
Yeah, that's pretty brutal. I remember when we spoke about the Belarus one, what was really interesting was that there was no league winner, because I think the top two teams were involved in match fixing. So they obviously stripped both of them of any titles and honours. But rather than give it the league to the next place team, they just said there was no winner, which I think is quite unusual. I can't quite, I think one of their, they did send teams to Europe. So I presume those were just the next best uncorrupt teams. But that was absolute chaos in Belarus, wasn't it? I think it was actually such a bad problem that people were talking about, you know, can Belarusian football even come back after such a massive scandal?
One that I accidentally stumbled upon online, which really amused me, was the case of Arminia Bielefeld in 1971-72, because they were involved in a bribery scandal. They had 21 points deducted, which is also a significant punishment, isn't it? But the thing that amused me the most about this is the line in the article I read that said, "The scandal came to light at the 50th birthday party of the Kickers Offenbach president, where an audio tape was played." And I was just thinking, who is a whistleblower at a birthday party? Who does that?
It's proper Poirot stuff, isn't it? I'm going to gather every single person and then I'm going to play them a tape. I've got to say, they could have waited to the next day, couldn't they? I guess he would have been hungover the next day. They could have waited another day after that.
Yeah, 2 days after at least, I think would have been fair. We also do have to give a shout out for the Everton one this season, 10 points for financial breaches. And I think the biggest one in any European football that I'd ever heard of before this one on Pontypridd was for Karen Shebus of Romania. They were deducted 96 points in 2016 for debts and suspected match fixing. If you listened to this podcast as far back as April or May, you will have heard us actually talk about that on the pod. But that is, at the moment, the biggest single points deduction that actually got applied, because obviously this Pontypridd one is still very much on hold. Any more shouts for points deductions, or shall we move on to Hercules Ajax?
Oh, I think we have to talk about Hercules and Ajax. This was a very interesting... there's been a lot from this that I've read that has made me laugh. So yeah, I'd love to hear your take on this one.
Well, tell me first, what's made you laugh?
Well, obviously Hercules beating Ajax, one of the biggest shocks in probably in Dutch football history to some degree. I think we'll all agree on that. But one of the things that's cracked me up a bit is they've been referred to as a Sunday league team quite a lot, which is technically true. They do play on a Sunday. It's how the division at that level is structured. But I just feel that the connotation to an English person is slightly different to the reality. Because in England, if I talk about a Sunday league team, I am really genuinely talking about me and a group of overweight dads who go out and play, and you're struggling to get enough people, and we're all paying subs, and we have to put the nets up and take them down. And okay, Ajax have been beaten. It's one of the most embarrassing results in their history. But to see a Sunday league team, I think it slightly gives the impression they're a little bit more amateur, well, a little bit more unprofessional than they are, because they are a fourth tier team, I believe. Am I right in saying? And they're probably a lot more professional than me and my Sunday league team.
Maybe professional in their approach, but by definition, they are an amateur team. They are a fourth division team, which in the Netherlands does make them, they are amateur.
So. Yeah, sorry, professional probably wasn't the word, but in terms of, they will probably look a lot more like a decent footballing outfit. Don't get me wrong, amazing shock. It just cracked me up some to see Sunday league team, because it always makes me remember those terrible games that I must have played in when I was in my sort of early 20s, where, yeah, no ref turns up and the pitch is all mud and nobody really wants to go out there because it's too cold. I'm thinking they've been beaten by a lowly team, but they're not quite that lowly.
With some cracking goals as well. I don't know if you've seen the highlights, but some of the goals, especially the second goal that they scored, absolutely brilliant stuff. One thing that I particularly was amused by was the fact that Ajax have had a bit of a resurgence in the league recently after that terrible start to the season. For this game, the coach, Van Schip, was at his son's wedding in Australia. So he's probably thought, I've steadied the ship, pardon the pun, I've steadied the ship, they're doing okay, they've got a fourth division amateur team in the cup, I can afford to go to Australia for his wedding, and then this happens.
Oh, I didn't realise that, that's absolutely fantastic. And he's probably woken up, I don't know what the time difference was, but say like it's early in the morning, wake up, just check your phone, wait a minute, 3-2? Yeah, I don't know what I feel about that. I'm always a big one for the fact that life and family has to take priority over football. You know, there's far too much, especially when people glorify players going back to play on the day their first child's born or something like that. And you think, actually, you know, there are bigger things in life. But I don't know, son's wedding versus cup tie, I'm not sure. Maybe son could have got married a bit closer to home. I don't know.
Yeah. We've seen obviously quite a few cup sets this season. We've seen Saarbrücken doing really well in Germany. They knocked out both Bayern Munich and Eintracht Frankfurt. We've seen a few in the Copa del Rey as well. And that just makes you realise, I think, the importance of open competition where teams at every level of the pyramid can play against and beat each other. And of course, the reason I'm saying this is because the Super League have made a comeback after the European Court of Justice ruled that the attempts by UEFA to stop breakaway competitions are indeed unlawful. I think the listeners will know roughly what our take is on that, but why don't we spell it out for them?
Yeah, it's quite easy to know where we'd stand. I mean, yeah, of course, the Super League is not a positive thing. It's a closed system. And as such, it goes against everything that, you know, we stand for on this pod. The whole idea is that everybody gets their shot. You know, everybody has a chance, and maybe their chance is much less than someone else, but it's possible that any team could get to the very top. So it does stand against that. The only mitigator, I wouldn't say it's a mitigator necessarily for Super League, but the only thing that in a way is quite depressing is that the changes that UEFA want to make to the Champions League, for example, are also stripping the beauty of that tournament too. So it's slightly depressing seeing UEFA trying to stand up as the voice of, you know, we believe in equality, when actually they themselves are pretty dreadful too.
I still think that that would be the lesser of two evils. One thing that really made me think that was, I saw a tweet on X, as it's now known, the other day, from Ewan McTeer, and he said, if this proposed Super League format was in place today, then this season's incredible Girona squad would have to wait until 2026-27 at the very earliest to play in the top football competition in Europe. Is that what they mean by open? And that really sort of hammered it home to me how long the wait would be. Whereas obviously, if they were to win the league this season and then go straight into a UEFA competition, then they're playing in the top competition the very next season.
Yeah, when you think about what they're saying, it just goes against the entire purpose of sport, does it not? I mean, the whole point of sport is everybody has an opportunity to win, and then the next time everyone has an opportunity to win. But what they're trying to do is create closed shops where some people are more equal than others. And it is, yeah, it's abhorrent and it's greed. And it's basically a testament to how mismanaged some of the top teams in the sport have been, that they've suddenly created a situation where, in order to survive in the way that they are existing, they need something like this, because they have butchered football to the point where it's become this money machine that they've bled dry, and now they need another way to protect their investments. And it's horrible, and it's absolutely abject, and of course we stand counter to it. And as I say, the only sad thing for me is that I feel like actually UEFA are also trying to move football in this way, but just less awfully. so yeah, we stand very much against Super League, except for the, as you point out on our Twitter, the very many Super Leagues that take place domestically around the world.
Yeah, of course. Moldova, Kosovo, Romania, they've all got Super Leagues. To touch back on the Ajax versus Hercules tie, what is the biggest sort of upset, cupset, surprise result you've ever seen live at the stadium?
Ooh, that's a very good question. I've not been to very many. So as a Bristol City fan, I think the biggest one for me is Bristol City beating Liverpool. That was my formative one. So it was one of my first games of football, in fact, that I ever went to. So I'd been to Bristol City games for about a year, and then we drew Liverpool in the FA Cup. And the funny thing about this one was that the first tie against Liverpool, the floodlights failed, showed how great a club we were at the time. So everyone had to come back again, and we drew with them. And so when you draw with Liverpool at home, at the time they were the superpower of English football, you presume you're not going to win at Anfield, but we did win at Anfield. And I think it finished off Graham Souness. Not literally, he didn't die, but he was sacked after that. So yeah, I always look back at that as my sort of big formative cup tie moment, because listening to that on the radio, Brian Tinian scoring, and our tiny little club as we were at the time beating Liverpool. I'll never forget that. And as you say, these moments when you're in your early football watching days kind of set the tone. I was like, I love cup football. How about you? Have you got a kind of a cup tie that you remember very fondly?
Not like a one-off cup tie, but the biggest upset I've ever seen would have to be that Rapid Vienna Vaduz game in the final Conference League qualifying round last season. To be at the stadium in Vienna, that was pretty much by chance. I saw that Vaduz had drawn Rapid, and I thought, well, I'm in the city, I live nearby, might as well go to that game, and ended up seeing, you know, a huge upset with all the Vaduz players and coaches and support staff streaming onto the pitch after the final whistle. In fact, that footage that I took ended up being used by like the likes of BBC, all sorts later that night, because it, you know, it was such an upset, and no journalists were there really, other than the ones that usually cover those clubs. So that would have to be it for me.
That was amazing. I remember seeing that very enviously from your Twitter account, because at the time we weren't doing the sweeper. So yeah, I remember looking at that and thinking, oh God, he was there. Amazing. And yeah, it, as you say, I think it was picked up everywhere, because nobody expected that to be a place where something was going to happen. Yeah, what a tie.
It is one of the many, many matches that we've been to that we've now uploaded onto our Memento account. And if you missed our last episode, or you've been living under a rock somehow, let's remind you, Memento is a digital scrapbook app to track your attendance at sports events. And we are proudly sponsored by Memento Now. So whether it's the Premier League or San Marino, you can find all the matches you've been to, add your own photos, add your own match notes, and of course you can follow us at SweeperPod and see all the games we've been to and the ones that we're going to attend at the start of next year too. And if you follow us on the app, you will know before anyone else where our next game is, because it's mentioned in the description. So do check it out. There's a free download link in the episode description. And all in all, Paul, it's just a fantastic app, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been having a lot of fun with it. It's a really nice thing. I'm not somebody who's very good at keeping souvenirs, match tickets. You know, I know people who do a fantastic job of that stuff. And so for me, what's been lovely is going back through old pictures that I've got on phones and computers and remembering games I genuinely had forgotten because of this app. So going through and just saying, reliving these moments has been really, really enjoyable, actually.
Yeah, I was doing that with the Vaduz game the other day and uploading some of my photos of that I sort of took from the stands. So if you want to check that out, do check out the Memento app. As I say, free download link in the description. And a big thanks to Memento for sponsoring The Sweeper. That's it for part two. We'll be back in part three to talk about some weather and Christmas-related themes. Welcome back to part three of this Sweeper podcast, and we're going to be talking first of all about one of our very favourite places in world football, and that is of course Greenland. Greenland is usually a topic that we only touch upon in August when they make a brief appearance for their 1 week long football season. But why, Paul, might we talk about Greenland now?
Because there is a very special football match that gets played every year on New Year's Eve in Greenland, and your thinking is probably exactly right. How are they playing on New Year's Eve? It must be freezing cold. It is freezing cold. There's a sort of ceremonial game that takes place on the pitch in Nuuk, on the frozen pitch in the ice, between two clubs that are actually, they're not two of the like senior professional clubs. They're called Nuuk and GSS, and they play a game every single year. And former players come out. It's kind of a fun occasion. It's not taken particularly seriously. And they do a little kind of walk where they carry the Greenland flag and they walk through Nuuk to the stadium and play this game. And some of the players involved are, you know, in their 60s. It's kind of an old boys game, basically. It's played in sort of minus 10, minus 11 degrees. And it's just sort of a thing they do every year. And it looks absolutely amazing. Everyone's in about seven layers of clothing. I've not actually seen what the game looks like, the football of the game, but I imagine it's pretty haphazard. But it's a really fun thing that this happens every year. I found out about it because I went to Greenland some years ago. I never shut up about it. And I met some really lovely people, added some of them on Facebook. And one year I was just scrolling through and saw this guy, John Torsen, had posted a picture of them walking to the game and then all this Greenlandic underneath. And I was like, what is this? You can't be playing football. So yeah, I exchanged some messages with him and got to the bottom of the fact that every year there is this game. And it's a really beautiful tradition, I think.
I don't know if it's weird for me to be surprised by the fact that it's only minus 10 or minus 15, because somehow I have it in my mind that in Greenland, in sort of the middle of winter, that the temperatures would be lower than that.
I think they do get lower than that. To be fair, I'm going on what it was last season, and it was about minus 11. And I do get the impression it was maybe a little bit warmer than normal. I think about now it's between minus 10 and minus 20, I think, which is certainly cold enough, especially when you factor in, I think it can feel colder with the wind chill. But yeah, I think maybe December isn't the coldest month. I think maybe January and February are the coldest month. But yeah, minus 13 will certainly be... That's a testing temperature to play at.
When I saw that we were going to talk about this on the pod, I looked for the coldest places in Europe where football might be played. And initially I was taken to an article on Politico, which named the five coldest places in Europe from 2022. Do you want to know what was on the list?
Yeah, can I guess one?
Yeah, sure.
Is Svalbard on there?
It's not. The thing is, they've not gone with entirely serious answers, which is why if you guessed all five, I'd be flabbergasted.
Right.
So they listed Greenland, and among the other things on the list was Iceland, inside Mario Draghi's Italian government, and Rishi Sunak's heart.
Oh, okay. They've gone that way with it.
Yeah.
Right. Fair enough. Definitely there are colder games played. So I remember tweeting about a game in Mongolia that had been played quite recently in about -7 or -8 degrees. And I was thinking, God, that is just so cold. And I got quite a flurry of messages from people from, I think someone from who lived in Russia and some who lived around the Baltic region just saying, -7? God, that's lovely. The tropical day compared to what we play in. So I think I do have to take a step back sometimes and say, okay, people are pretty hard. They will play in incredibly cold conditions.
I remember this was years ago, but in 2005, I went on a school trip to Russia. And they, for some reason, decided to organize the trip in February, where the temperatures in both Moscow and St. Petersburg were -22. And it was absolutely agonizing. So I don't know how people play football in those temperatures.
No, I think actually what was scariest for me in Mongolia was I didn't feel that cold. And that was the weird thing. It sounds silly, but it didn't feel necessarily any colder at times than it would on a really, really, really cold day in the UK. But the difference was, the difference between sort of -2 or -3 and -20 on a kind of crisp day was quite subtle. And you only noticed it when you got inside and you realized the damage it had done to you. So I realized that you could actually get yourself into quite serious trouble if you're a bit naive and you're in a country where it's, because you don't necessarily feel that, especially if you're running around or doing stuff. It's only when you get inside and you realize how horribly frozen parts of you are that you think, oh God, like actually, you've got to take the cold a lot more seriously than perhaps I did.
You know what this topic made me think of? It made me think of that 2022 World Cup qualifier between Canada and Mexico. Do you remember the one that took place in Edmonton, Alberta?
Yes, yes. And wasn't there a conspiracy theory of sorts that Canada had put it there on purpose for it to be incredibly cold? But then that kind of got blown up because people were saying, well, a lot of the Canadian players don't play in Canada anyway. And, you know, there were a lot of people saying, no, this is just, it's just where it was going to be. But I do remember that game and how I think Canada did win, didn't they, as well?
Yeah, they did win. Yeah. And that helped them get towards the World Cup. But the stadium in question is nicknamed Estadio Azteca by the fans. Sort of a spin on words on Azteca. But yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was -9, the temperature that day.
That is very, very cold. That is very, very cold. Was it a two-legged match? Did they have to play the other leg in Mexico? I think they did. So, in fact, they probably played it at the Azteca, the other one. So that is there is something quite brilliant about that.
You were, of course, born in Alberta. Did you live there for your younger years or did you...
6 months. So my parents had to smuggle me back to the UK at 6 months old. I have a dual citizenship. Which is a very useful thing to have. I was born in Lethbridge, Alberta, and it's an incredibly nondescript town. It's somewhere that no one really goes as a tourist. And I remember trying to sort of get in touch with my roots and learn stuff about Lethbridge. And I remember Googling Lethbridge, and one of the like most searched topics was, what is that smell in Lethbridge? I think there's like some sort of reason why a certain wind brings a horrible smell. And also, we went back once and we were going to go, you know, as a sort of rite of passage to visit the hospital I was born in, and they'd torn it down. So I've had some very good moments, but yeah, very, very proud to be from Lethbridge.
I've definitely got some follow-up questions about the use of the word smuggled there, but I think I'll save those for a future bonus podcast when we're short on content.
When I get deported back to Canada.
From one winter topic to another, we're going to talk next about FC Santa Claus. If you follow us on Twitter, you'll have seen that before Christmas, we ran a kit competition for the brilliant FC Santa Claus football kit, which has either ho 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 or fear the beard on it. Absolutely lovely stuff. So a very big thank you to FC Santa Claus for running that competition with us. They play in the fifth division of Finnish football in a place called Rovaniemi up in the Arctic Circle, where it snows for just up to 200 days a year. So not much snowfall then.
That's amazing. I have some questions about this team. So they play year round, you know, because obviously at Christmas, you look at it as FC Santa Claus, brilliant. But they do play the whole year round, like any other team?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't used to be called FC Santa Claus. So I think it happened about 30 years ago. When I was in touch with Juha Etelainen, the media officer for this kit competition, I said, can I ask you some questions about this name? Because obviously I wanted to know sort of... mostly wanted to know, do they just get a crazy load of media requests around Christmas time and then the rest of the year, you know, it's quiet? And he explained to me, in the early 90s, we asked Santa if it was okay to use his name. It was, and here we are. That was the explanation.
Yeah, I love that there's a team called that. I just like the idea of them playing year round, sort of in their Santa themed kit, just turning up in March. But I guess they're pretty close to the Arctic Circle. So as you say, it's kind of a miracle they can play with those 200 days of snow a year. They must be pretty hardened players themselves to be playing in those conditions.
Yeah, the club's invented a new sport called snow football or something, but where they basically play football in heavy snowfall. And it sort of then starts to resemble rugby because you're just kicking up snow and there's bodies flying everywhere. Yeah, it looks like a lot of fun, but obviously very adverse conditions to play football in, especially when you factor in what happens to their pitch in 2009. Do you know about what happened to the FC Santa Claus pitch in 2009, Paul? If anyone else in world football knows that, it's going to be you.
I don't, but I'd love to know.
They dug it up in 2009 to replace the pitch with artificial turf and stick in undersoil heating, which I imagine in that part of the world is absolutely necessary. And in the process, they discovered that an unexploded German artillery shell was buried under the pitch, and they had to get it detonated by the Lapland Air Defence Regiment.
I shouldn't laugh, but that's absolutely amazing. God, who would have thought? What a crazy thing to happen.
Yeah, absolutely mental. I did also enjoy the fact that because of their name, they've had some amazing marketing opportunities. This was a good while ago now, but they were flown to China twice by a marketing company. And they also played a football match alongside Alessandro Del Piero and Michael Owen, which are, as you have put it, those are things that would never have happened to the club if it hadn't been for the FC Santa Claus name.
That's amazing. Yeah, I love that. I did see what about the name. So this is quite funny, given that it's a very cozy, lovely story. It says, following a bankruptcy filing, the club reformed as a new entity called FC Santa Claus Arctic Circle. So you wonder what happened with that bankruptcy hearing. They said, look, guys, we're just going to call ourselves Santa Claus because no one's going to really question us about our taxes again.
Yeah, wow. That is definitely one of those Wikipedia lines that makes you ask some questions, isn't it? Let's move on to our final weather topic in this segment. All I've got is a match between Trapani and Licata. Heavy winds wreak havoc. So what happened?
Well, first of all, I will credit, as we like to do, I will credit Nicola Chiappianelli, I believe it is. So at Nick Chiappa, K-I-A-P-P-A, because that's where I got this from. And I like to follow for the craziness of lower league Italian football. There was a game between Trapani and Licata. And this is, again, Italian lower leagues, Italian Serie D. The wind was so strong that there's a crazy series of events that you get to see as a video here where the goalkeeper blasts the ball away in a kind of clearance. The defenders turn their back on him because the ball looks like it's gone miles off the field. And they're kind of turning their back to say, come on, you know, play it short. And what they don't realise is that the wind is such that the ball blows back into play. So these defenders are basically stopped playing. Ball blows back into play to one of the opposition players who then basically does bag it, put it into the back of the net. So it's this ridiculous goal. Then later on, there's a penalty where the goalkeeper makes a save and the ball blows all the way back into play so far that it goes off the other side for a corner. So it's absolutely amazing. The wind's just playing absolute havoc with this game. But yeah, the funniest thing is this clearance where you can see the defenders turn their back and say, for goodness sake, you know, you've put it over the stand. What's the point? And then the ball just comes back into the box, which looks like someone's thrown another ball in from the stand. That's how bad the wind was. But again, as we say, in some of these lower league games, they get the game on regardless of how crazy the conditions are.
I have been to Sicily. It was some years ago, but I had a lovely time and the weather was great. And now we've had two stories about weather-related incidents involving Trapani over the past couple of weeks, because we had the one with the cancelled ferry, didn't we, on the bonus podcast a few weeks back?
Yeah, we did, didn't we? And the I think that was the brilliantly named Angry, who were supposed to be turning up to Trapani for a Serie D Cup tie. And the boat got cancelled, but seven of their fans made their way there anyway, possibly over land, and put up that banner saying, basically, yeah, in absence of a real game, we're here for the ideal of a game, you know, basically. And it said, yeah, Angry Group or whatever they call themselves, which is fantastic. So yeah, they're quite a strange series of weather-related Sicilian stories recently. And yeah, an eventful time for FC Trapani.
I would say, Paul, I don't know about you, but I would say that if people want to hear more about the Angry Crazy Group and the goings on in Trapani, they should subscribe to us on Patreon and listen to our bonus podcast that we did about that incident, because that is exactly the kind of need to know bonus content that you get on our pods, isn't it? In addition to the already publicized perks like newsletters and Discord access. And now, heading into the new year, we are potentially going to have a new bonus perk. So why don't we tell the listeners about the Timpu City project? Let's see if we can do it in 60 seconds.
So basically, there's a second best football club in Bhutan currently, are Timpu City. They are looking for people to help the club continue. It's been a really hard time for clubs in Bhutan. We would like to offer our patrons the chance to get involved and be part of this club with sort of monthly calls and, you know, whatever people would like to do. I want to try and help them facilitate and make them part of a football club in Bhutan.
Yeah, I think it's very much in the works at the moment, isn't it? This is something that we're thinking about. It's not for sure, but we are seriously considering this and a sort of gauging feedback from existing patrons and followers and listeners as well. So if we do get enough interest, we will press ahead with that. Initially, there will only be a limited number of spaces, and those will be offered to our existing patrons first. So I guess that makes now the ideal time to support us on Patreon. You can do that at patreon.com/sweeperpod. It makes a huge contribution to what we're doing at the moment, and it would be the perfect Christmas present. So do sign up to the Patreon if you are able and want to. Any more business, Paul, before we finish off our final episode of 2023?
No, I think that's me for the year. But what a year it's been, and I definitely want to say a very heartfelt thank you to everyone who's been with us this year on this journey, because it's been an amazing experience to be part of this pod and to bring this kind of passion project to life. I think for both of us means huge amount, and we really couldn't do it without this group of people who have come together and supported us, whether that's being a patron or just simply listening to it. It's something that, you know, I've always wanted to do. And I love that there are enough of us who still like this side of the game to make it something that we can do.
Yeah, I would echo those sentiments. I started out doing this simply because I enjoyed researching things like the Moldovan Super League and what's happening in Turkmenistan and all the people that have shared their enthusiasm for these topics with us and joined in and left nice comments. It's been really, really wonderful, very rewarding. And we can't wait to get stuck into the new year in 2024. So we hope that you'll join us then. And we look forward to bringing you the next podcast on, I think, Wednesday, the 10th of January. So happy new year, and we'll see you then.